Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting here with Sarah McDewling, and we're sitting across from Rosie Waterland. Talk about a new memoir, Every Lie I've Ever Told. Welcome, Rosie.
Thanks for having me. You've got a really good podcast voice. Oh, it's really soothing and nice.
Yeah.
He
enunciates.
Does it? Is that just because it was the first 30 seconds, so you're thinking about it, and by the end you'll...
Yeah, I get hysterical.
Sound like Edna Krabappel or something, yeah.
Oh, I really hope so. That's my hope for this podcast.
I'm just going to edit all of this out. I'm sorry. Let's stay on topic. On topic.
This is the topic. You're the topic. Okay. You're writing memoir. Anything you do is the topic.
Okay.
So tell us, why after writing your first memoir and the struggles and... trials and tribulations of Australian publishing and bookselling and sitting down and writing, did you make the choice to do it all over again?
My contract.
It was a gun.
Yeah, I had no choice. No, I signed a 2-book non-fiction deal. So, I had to. And, you know, I think it's a bit ridiculous to have 2 memoirs when you're 31, like I just turned 31. And so I had originally planned for this second book to just be a series of essays based around the title, Every Lie I've Ever Told. And then, of course, my best friend died last year, so then it did turn into a bit more of a linear memoir narrative again, which I hadn't intended, because I just was like, okay, well, my childhood was interesting, so I felt like the first memoir, The Anti-Cool Girl, was warranted, but I was like, another memoir is just a bit insufferable, like, go away, 30-year-old millennial who thinks they can have 2 books about their life. But yeah, I thought, but a second book of funny essays I can get away with, that's like a bit David Sedaris-y, isn't it? Like, that's fine. But then, after my friend died, it changed a little. So, yeah, that's my answer. Contract, I had to.
So when you talk about every lie you've ever told, do we count white lies, like big lies, small lies? Did you have to do some sort of idea or consolidation of what lie meant and how big, like if they're... Were they big lies that you had in your head, or were you just going to go, I'm going to write a 10-volume memoir or set of essays about every lie I've ever told? Because there's a lot of lies we tell.
Yeah, well, yeah, I didn't put any limitations on it. So, I mean...
You could still be writing if you were going with that first original essay idea.
Yeah, of course, yeah. And then some of them are silly, like... There's one chapter that's titled, I've Never Been the Head of a Crime Ring. And then I talk about how I... had organized quite a really intense and detailed theft operation from my high school canteen.
I'm so impressed by it.
Yeah. And so, I guess the lie is I have been head of a major crime operation, but I was in year 9 and it only lasted a month. But then there's other more serious lies like, you know, I've never had an abortion. Like, yes, I have. And so then I talk about that. And it's just a mixture of things. And then, you know, the last lie in the book. What was interesting to me was while I was writing this book and my mental health was kind of going downhill as I was grieving for my friend, I was actually lying to everybody the whole time about how I was doing and how I was handling it. And when I got to the end of the book, I was like, oh my God, I've actually been telling the biggest and most poignant lie this kind of whole time, which is that I'm okay. So that's why the last chapter in the book is I'm okay, because so that was a lie. I wasn't.
You started writing. So you'd already started writing when your friend...
Yes, I had. So I'd started writing most of the funny chapters in the book were stories that I'd been working on already. And that's why they're all just kind of disjointed and can be read on their own as single essays or short stories. And then the linear narrative woven throughout the book is after my friend died. So you can sort of tell which ones, what was written when, I think.
It's amazing. You said, I don't know, did you just use the word disjointed?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it is in a way, but it feels so... perfectly balanced in another way.
Phew.
Like I would be, if I just went through and read the linear story, I'd like, you need a break in between those.
Yes, you do. It'd be too much.
Yeah, I think you've been very kind to readers, like entertaining them in between, like, all of this heartbreaking stuff.
Yeah, that's important to me. And that was important to me with my first book as well. Because, you know, I had quite a dark, traumatic childhood, but that book, I think, was very funny. I mean, A, because I like to write comedy, but also because it'd be a bit insufferable otherwise. Like, who wants to read that only?
You need the laughs.
You need the laughs, yeah.
You're not laughing, you're crying.
It'd be a bit Dickensian and, like, over the top. Yeah.
I'm interested in that period after, because grief, you know, throws you around and depression throws you around and things like that. And concentration is one of those hard bits, like to keep concentrating on one, other than the things you're already, your brain's just naturally going round and round on. To be able to, how hard was it to write the after book? I mean, it was because deadlines were coming and there was expectations of the things like, was it difficult? Of course it was a difficult process.
Yeah.
Is it hard to tough? Like, I'm reading at the moment, everyone. Just got my hands on a copy yesterday and I think it's the greatest tragedy that I can't have spent the whole of this day previous to now finishing it.
Yeah.
Because it's all I really want to do at the moment. But I'm just up to the part, I just started the chapter where you're being possessed by the devil, but...
Yeah, right.
Spoiler!
But
right before that is when you've written Tony's eulogy, and what I found amazing, because it's phenomenal that you're able to have done this book, given everything that has been going on, and you spoke about just feeling like you needed to write the eulogy but couldn't do it because there was too much going on, felt like you couldn't write a word, and then it all just poured out of you. Was the book a bit like that?
Yes, that was, the eulogy was probably a mini version of what I was going through with the book, like in terms of the timing. I had a few weeks to do that, and obviously with the book I had, you know, a few months still left until my deadline, and my deadline got pushed. Like, this book basically got finished and went to the printers, like, a week later. Like, yeah, it was week because it was, like you say, John, it's hard to think of a word other than difficult, but it was just really difficult to concentrate to get it done, partly because I have post-traumatic stress disorder from my childhood, which I assumed I'd largely recovered from. Like, I live with it... you know, quite successfully now, and Tony, my friend, dying triggered a lot of those symptoms again. So I started, I felt like my mental health had just gone backwards, like by 10 years in a day, and I didn't quite know how to handle it. I think my mental health had gotten to such a healthy place that I'd gotten quite cocky about it, and I didn't think I'd have to handle it at its worst again. And so I was sort of struggling to manage my mental illness while trying to finish the chapters about Tony in this book. And I kept saying to Catherine, my publisher at HarperCollins, yes, I've got pages, I'm doing it, I'm sending it to you. And like, I wasn't, like, I think they think I was lying. I think they think I wrote it in the last week, but I was doing it, but I was just paralyzed with, I was very concerned about making it this perfect kind of tribute to my friend, because I was like, once it's printed and it's in words and it's written, I can't change it. And so I would write it, and then I said to Catherine, I felt like so much of what I wrote was just dead words. It was just, I was writing a lot and then reading it back and being like, there's no rosy voice in this. And I have a very specific writing voice. Like, it was like I was just saying, I woke up in the morning, this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened, and then I went to bed. Like, there was nothing, I'd lost all kind of creative flair and artistic spark, and it took me a while.
Around that particular area of the book?
Yes, yeah. Around the, like, just, and even the, because I was still finishing off some of the other just funnier stories, and I even just couldn't do those, like, it was like my creative kind of brain just shut down, and so it took a while to really just keep, like, I don't know if it's writer's block, because I was writing a lot, but I was just writing shit, and so I had to just keep doing it and doing it and doing it and doing it, and then something just kind of clicked.
It's one of those things that it's interesting when so many writers give advice, and so you've got this smorgasbord of advice. Oh, look at that bit and that bit over there. Mm. But something that a lot of them actually agree on is just writing through it, even if you're writing shit, or even going to the desk and filling in the hours that you're meant to be there, and then going away, and if you've written nothing.
Yeah.
But making sure you get through that period.
Yeah.
Don't wander away from the mechanism, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think you also have to accept the limitations of whatever your process has to be at the time. Like, whatever I had to do to end up getting that book out, I think the book is out, so I did it. It stressed out my publisher, but I did it. There was a lot of TV breaks included, and a lot of, I'll just look at this thing on Wikipedia for 5 hours before I write that chapter. But, you know, I've tried to be very gentle with myself and forgiving of myself for taking so long. And I'm lucky that HarperCollins have also been really nice about it, because they could, I'm pretty sure Catherine like almost had a heart attack. So, yeah.
So I was reading about it, because I've met you a couple of times, and you get this impression of being sort of in certain circumstances of being quite vivacious and quite chatty and the rest of it. But then you will say in interviews that I'd rather be sitting in bed with my under the duvet watching TV.
Yeah, I would. I hate anyway. This.
Yeah.
Who would have? I'll go there now.
But I'm just wondering, for one, there's the book and sharing. Yeah. One thing. Social media is another place where you put yourself out. But then going on tour with a comedy show is something else altogether. Another place where is it the safety of the stage?
It is. I mean, I went to drama school, so I'm like technically a trained actor. It doesn't mean I'm good. But So, you know, I'm comfortable on stage. I like performing. I like entertaining people. I like engaging with people. And that, to me, is a lot easier than having to socialize with people I don't know. Like, I would much rather get up on stage and do stand-up to a room of 1,000 people than go to a party of 50 people where I don't know anyone in the room. So it's hard for me to describe. I mean, I've heard people use the term introverted extrovert, but I know that I just need a very specific amount of time to myself, and I get really nervous if I don't have it. But stuff like this, like sitting here talking to you guys, it's I guess there's an element of me faking it. No offense.
Who are you?
Feigning confidence, I guess. Like, this stuff does make me nervous. I do get nervous, and you know, people, like fans come up to me on the street sometimes, and I don't want to discourage them from doing it because it's lovely, but I get uncomfortable just because I am very shy. And to me, it's lovely to hear that they have been, you know, affected by something that I've written, but also at the same time, I'm like, I don't know you, and I'm terrible at small talk, and I don't know what to say.
I wanted to ask you about that, actually, because of the nature of your writing. I think everyone feels after they've read your books, that they're your friend.
Like,
because you confide so much, and you go through the full gamut of emotions in your books, like to laughter to tears. And you end that feeling a closeness to you that I wonder how that translates for you when strangers are like, hey, it's me.
Oh, no, No, it's lovely. I mean, I get hugged a lot, just without asking, which is fine. Like, I'm not like Seinfeld with Kesha.
That
was amazing. But I would never do that. Like, I will gladly accept the hug.
No, thank you.
Yeah, that was so amazing. I mean, they do, and I like that they do, because it means that my writing is having the effect that I want it to have. I'm just a lot shyer than what people realize. And I think there probably are some people out there who have met me on the street and maybe think I'm like a bitch, like, because I'm really quiet and quite reserved, and I get nervous and funny, and it's honestly just because I'm like socially inept and awkward, and I don't know how to handle it. Yeah. Yeah. So,
So to all those people out there.
I love you guys. I'm just socially.
Just don't talk to me.
Yeah, just don't talk to me. No, it's fine. I'm just like the most awkward person. I can't. I'm not good at it. So.
It makes sense, though. I think as you see it a lot with a lot of creative people, especially people who are funny.
Yeah.
That it's like, you know, in a social situation, it's totally different from performing. It's not like just the presence of people that's going to make you. It's not like you walk into Pioneer feel awkward because there's people there. It's
yeah.
Because there's people all interacting equally, and you have to navigate that and have exchanges in conversations. Like performing is like. You all be quiet and I'm in control.
Yeah, like, yeah. It yeah. is. So it's very different. I'm a lot more comfortable on stage than probably I even am right now with you two in front of me.
Staring
so,
at you.
Yeah. Oh, God, so much pressure.
We spoke a little bit about this before the podcast, but and I know you probably can't say anything specifically what you're doing, but... other books that you might write in the future?
Well, I super want to do fiction because I'm tapped out. Like I said, two memoirs at 31 is ridiculous already, so I'm done. Like I've told all my stories. Plus, because my life now literally just includes me drinking wine in my undies and watching TV, so like I don't know what I would even write about. So I've got to start making stuff up. So fiction definitely next.
I'm really excited about that.
Yeah.
Any clues of direction? Are we going to see some sort of action thriller? Or like what is it? What is it you mean? Like what are the themes that you're interested in?
Well, I don't know if I would do an action thriller. I mean, maybe erotica. I love this author called Natasha Walker. She's a huge inspiration. We're going to edit that out. No, I definitely, it will be, to be honest, whatever fiction I write, I imagine it will be quite a hyperbolic version of myself, a protagonist, heroine. I like writing funny stuff. I like writing real stuff. But I've told all my funny stories, so I just need a vehicle through which to make up funny stories. So I hope that gives you enough of a clue about what I'm doing.
I love to look forward to reading those. I think it would be amazing. The way you interpret your own life is so hilariously funny that when you've got the freedom to just create a character and make their life whatever you want.
Yeah, like I can only have so many toilet mishaps, so I need to start just making them up now.
And you can probably just, you take your original ones, which are, some of them probably don't even work in nonfiction because they're too absurd.
Yes.
No one's going to believe that. I'll put it into a fiction.
Yes.
I just realised you started both books that way.
Yeah, I did. No, I said that at the end. I didn't even realise. And I was like, oh my God, I started both books with like the word shit in the first paragraph. Like I did, that was unintentional, which I think says a lot about my psyche.
That's your motif.
Yeah.
God, I didn't make that connection to the first one. But the one in this book is particularly explosive.
Yeah, explosives. Very apt description.
When we get writers in here, we like to sort of get behind the scenes just a tad.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the things like basic things like what do you read? Like what do you read as a are you a TV and film person, or are you a reader, or are you like I mean the way you write, I assume you've got some reading under your belt.
Yeah, I mean,
and TV rec, please.
Sorry,
and she made reference.
Book rec and TV rec now.
Yeah.
Okay, well, yeah, I certainly, and I hate saying this as an author myself, but I devote a lot more time to watching television than reading books. Like I have to be upfront about that. You know, which is why I'm in television writing now. That's another thing that I'm doing. But I mean, television recommendations. Oh my gosh, Atlanta with Donald Glover is amazing. The Handmaid's Tale, obviously. Mm. I was on the writing staff for a new Australian show coming out called Sisters, which is really amazing. That'll be on Channel 10 later this year. Just plug.
When you say writing staff, like what image? And we meant to have. It's a whole people sitting, a lot of people sitting around a desk just throwing
crazy ideas. Yeah,
what's it like? Oh my God, you guys, it's amazing. It's amazing. And especially when you're writing books, which is such a solitary activity. And, you know, I like I said, I went to drama school. I'm very used to collaborating with a lot of other people. And so it literally is you and a group of writers sit in a room and the room is surrounded by whiteboards. And let's just say you're plotting one episode that day, and you'll just start at the start of the whiteboards, and you'll just talk about, you just plot an episode, you decide what's going to happen, you all pitch in ideas, and by the end of the day, you've kind of worked out exactly what's happening in the episode, and then one person goes away and writes it. So it's literally just people sitting around a table telling funny stories and being like, oh my gosh, let's put that in and let's put that in, and it's the best.
Sarah, so it is Sarah, like 30 Rock, is it?
Yeah. Yes, it is. It's exactly like any TV writing that you've seen depicted on TV. It's like that.
Great.
That
so sounds like the best. Our CVs are ready to
handle. Yeah. It's the best.
Please let me be a TV writer. I have no qualifications, but I would really enjoy it.
I know, it's the best job. Like, I love writing books, but getting into TV writing has been just the best. It's like a dream come true for me the last couple of years.
So, like, you're having the chat, blah, 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 and someone comes with a great line. Does that line go onto the whiteboard?
Yeah. Like, if someone comes up with a great line, you definitely write it down, remember to put it in. And then, you know, it's not all funny stories. Like, often Sisters is produced by the people who produce Offspring, so it's kind of a dramedy show. And so you'll talk about really sad things that have happened in your life, and you just... It's just the best, most collaborative, fun, creative job. Highly recommend.
I'm talking.
Yeah, it's so amazing.
I'm so jealous.
I'm very jealous too. And you're working on a TV show of your own?
Yes, I am. So it's in, we're sort of developing the first episode now, and we'll hopefully start filming early next year.
And you're acting in it?
Yeah, man. Awesome. Playing myself.
So it'll be about you.
Easiest role for me to play.
Oh, so it's based on, like...
It's like loosely... a lot of people wanted to option The Anti-Cool Girl when it came out, but I felt really uncomfortable about selling my life rights. Mm. I felt really strange about that. So I ended up going with a production company who were happy to let me sort of develop something loosely based on it, but... I like to tell people it's kind of like Please Like Me, but with a chubby girl protagonist instead of a skinny gay boy protagonist. So that's my elevator pitch. I'm terrible at them, so I don't know. But it's exciting. It's sort of they say in the biz, you guys, in development.
Oh my God, it's so professional. Yeah. Is it going to be called The Anti-Cool Girl?
No. I don't think so. I don't know yet what it's going to be called.
And we can look forward to that sometime next year.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Oh, being patient for shows you want to watch is the worst.
Yeah. Soz guys. And books, oh my God. I've been reading Theft by Finding by David Starris, which is really good.
So that's the...
his journals. Yeah.
What do we see? There's something else coming out. He's... Doodles, like he's got all these images that are inside it. There's another book that's being published soon, which actually shows all the drawings he puts in the books.
Yeah, because he like takes so much more time than I do. Like, what a ledge. I just quickly draw an abstract vag in everybody's book. But when he signs books, he'll talk to the person. I read once that he said he has 12 different questions that he asks people, like, and he just alternates them, like, what's your star sign or what's your favorite food? And then based off what they say, he draws them a cute little picture in their book and then signs it. And apparently, because he's just a comedic genius, they're all really funny. And he's, apparently publishing a book with a lot of them.
Yeah, so and also the stuff that's in his diaries and anywhere where he drops down a little image. Yeah,
so that's actually, it's really good. And it's interesting to read his diaries that are... a lot of his essays have been based on, because apparently that's how he remembers all this stuff, is that he's been just a crazy diary writer for years and years and years.
Isn't that one of those things? I admire that.
Yeah, as soon as someone says that, you just go, regret.
Yeah, I know. Damn it.
All the years I haven't
read. All the things I have now forgotten.
Yeah.
And never coming back.
Exactly.
And when you read them, do you look at timing and the tones and that sort of stuff?
Oh, yeah. I could only dream to reach that level of skill. Like, I work in a similar way to David Sedaris, but I read him say once that he reads everything he writes out loud, which I also do, which I think comes from my acting background. Like, I imagine everything that I've written being performed or read, I guess. And so going back and reading my stuff out loud is really important for me to get a sense of the rhythm, the timing, the tone. And so, yeah, when you read someone like David Sedaris's books, he is just the master of it.
Yeah, people who don't do that, they realise their mistake when they're asked to read their own audiobook.
Yes.
And they read it aloud and they go, this is crap.
Yeah, yeah.
You're doing it at the moment, right, for your upcoming podcast?
Yeah, I've got a podcast coming out with my mum where we read every chapter of The Anti-Cool Girl, or I read every chapter of The Anti-Cool Girl, and then we talk about it because my mum's sober now, so she can talk about it. And, yeah, it's been very weird reading...
Yeah.
The book out loud.
My parents, whenever we tell stories, they go, you did what?
Like, yeah.
Is it like that? Was she reading the book going, really, that happened? It's
interesting because the podcast is called My Mum Says My Memoir Is a Lie.
Perfect.
Yeah. Yes, because, you know, so much of it is based on my childhood, which was severely affected by her alcoholism. She insists that a lot of the stuff I wrote didn't happen, and I'm like, yeah, but you were drunk, so you don't remember. And yeah. So, and now that she's sober, it's just very interesting seeing two perspectives on a shared experience. And I didn't want the podcast to be about me going, what the hell, why were you so terrible? I more just wanted it to be like, okay, if you say this chapter didn't happen, then tell me what you think happened.
Oh my
and
God.
So it's been like super interesting. Yeah, really interesting.
I have to hear.
I've got
that.
This image of the people who did the, my dad wrote a porno, doing a series based with the father listening to the podcast.
Yes.
And then having to
it's kind of like the book version of that. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, it must be stunning to sit across from your mum and to,
yeah.
to do
yeah.
this. It just blows my mind to think that you'd be... I mean, she'd be into it.
Has she read it? Is
she,
this her first hearing?
No,
it?
She had read it.
Okay.
Because she's been sober for a year now, and we started doing it a couple months ago. So she had read it once, but then I told her not to read it again because I said, I want it to be fresh when I'm reading it to you in the studio. And it's been difficult because there's some confronting stuff for her to have to sit and listen to, like about mine and my sister's time in foster care and things like that. It's funny though, the one chapter so far where she just totally froze up and didn't want to talk about it was the chapter where she caught me masturbating when I was a kid. It's like all these horrible things happened.
That's the thing.
Like us being in foster care and her not coming home and abandonment and trauma. And then that chapter she was like, I don't want to talk about this. No, I'm not going there. So... it's interesting what bothers her. And we're getting into the later chapters now, which aren't so much about her, and they're more about my adult life, and there's a lot of sex stuff, which I'm not quite sure how she'll handle, but we'll see.
Has she read this one?
Every lie I've ever told, I gave it to her a few days ago. So I don't know, maybe.
It's just been printed for Christ's sake.
Yeah, like it's literally hot off the press.
Yeah, some of the ink is still wet.
But I gave it to her, I gave her the first copy I got, so... maybe. I mean, she's been staying with me and she's been watching a lot of TV, so I don't know if she's read it. Probably not. Thanks, Mom.
Keep checking.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Spine not open.
Yeah.
Rosie, Sarah and I could chat to you all afternoon. But you have things to do. We've got some other books to sign and things like that.
We've a lot more books.
And yeah, a lot more vaginas to draw in inside covers. Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming in. Thank you so much for talking with us so openly about both your books and your TV life and podcasting and the stage. My God.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I have to also mention that I have a comedy tour coming up. Please buy tickets.
Yes, buy the tickets.
That will make my promoter really happy.
And both of...
They're on sale today, right?
Yeah, it goes on sale today. Yeah. So, and then also, yes, please buy my new book.
Yeah. And we've got...
Booktopia.
We've got both books on booktopia.com.au yeah. right now. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.